Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, president of Euro Pacific Capital. I host this show every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time. We simulcast the show on my website at www.europac.net and also on shortwave radio 5.07 megahertz. I'm also the author of the book Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. If you haven't already picked up a copy, please do so and get some extra copies for your friends. I think it is very valuable reading. Also, I am still working on my next book, which will be coming out, I believe, potentially still as early as October, if we're on track for that. That book is going to be the little book of bull moves in bear markets, so watch for that. I'm sure I'll send out an email when that book is ready to go. But in the meantime, you can still read Crash Proof. You know, also, last time I was on the show, you know, I mentioned that if we all could go to Amazon, which still, by the way, hasn't put my book back into the investment category, which I'm hoping to get back into. For some reason, there was a computer glitch, so it doesn't even show up as an investment book. But a number of you actually took the time to go to Amazon and to click on the number two review, the five-star review, and to click on it that it was helpful. And so we were able to move it from the number three position to the number two position. But in order to get it to the number one position, which I think should be the goal, and to get that number two review, that negative review, one of the seven out of 215, there are seven two-star reviews. There are 166 five-star reviews. If we can get that two-star review to move down a notch, we only need about another 200 people to click on the number two review, which is from a Financial Sense listener. It now has 471 people who have clicked on it. No, 521 people have clicked on it. 471 have found it helpful. I think I'm pretty sure we need to get above 745, although it's possible if we can just get above 501, because only 501 people found the number one view review helpful. So obviously if just 30 or 40 people click on, we'll have more people finding that review helpful. And I'm not exactly sure how Amazon ranks it, but there's a possibility that based on the number of people that found the review helpful, that we can jump above that negative review. So that would be good if we can accomplish that. So if you've, even if you've already read the book, you can come up. I thought the last review was very interesting. It was written by a Dr. Petrov, who is a university professor outside the United States, and he's telling me that he's actually using the book Crash Proof as a textbook in his class, and people are actually doing assignments, and they're required to read the book and write comments on it. And the interesting thing is, of course, it's, you know, he's not even in the United States. You know, it'd be, it would be better if we had more American professors encouraging their students to read this book. But I guess, you know, if they're doing it even in another country, it's flattering and it's better than nothing. And he mentions in the review, if you go on Amazon, you can read the review. And he talks about how at first the students are very skeptical, but he says by the end I'm the most popular author that they study for the semester. So that's interesting. But also a good comment on the book and a reason to read the book if it is something that you have yet to do. Anyway, the telephone number to call, I know we've got four or five callers already lined up, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Well, the big news, of course, today is the Fed, right? Everybody's been waiting for the Fed, and, you know, I've been saying and writing on my commentaries that I do not expect the Fed to raise interest rates anytime soon, even though they certainly should be raising them. In fact, they never should have reduced them. But I expected them to continue the rhetoric of being vigilant on inflation. Well, it seems to me that the statement that came out today didn't even do that. I thought it was one of the more dovish statements that the Fed could have come out with. I mean, they acknowledged the inflation risks, but they really downplayed them. I mean, if you read what they said, they said that they expect inflation to moderate, you know, over the balance of the year and next year, which, of course, is what the Fed has been saying, you know, all along. Their only acknowledgement of the higher inflation risks was acknowledging that inflation expectations are elevated due to some increases in prices. So basically what the Fed is saying is that we don't think there's an inflation problem. Other people do, but we disagree. We're going to monitor those expectations. But from their perspective, they're denying that there's inflation. In fact, they're saying that the evidence suggests that inflation is going to turn down when there's no such evidence of that at all. In fact, all the evidence suggests it's going to get worse. I mean, look at the deal that was just negotiated on Monday between the two major producers of iron ore, Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton, and the biggest steel producer in the world, which, of course, is a Chinese company. And the new contract calls for an 85% increase in the price of iron ore, retroactive to, I think, April. 85% increase, that's huge. And this is steel. This is to make steel. Steel goes into a lot of stuff. So, I mean, everything I'm seeing, I mean, how can Bernanke say that he feels inflation is going to moderate or turn down? I mean, the only reason he can think that is because he thinks the weak economy is going to counteract inflation. But, of course, he says he doesn't think the economy is that weak. He thinks some of the risks are gone. So it just whatever he's saying is lying. But basically what it really amounts to is Bernanke is basically saying, hey, I see nothing but sunny days ahead. But I've noticed a lot of people are carrying around umbrellas anyway. So, you know, we're going to be cautious of this.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, sorry about that. There was some problem with my phone. I know, I'm trying to remember what I was talking about before I lost you. I know it was about the Fed meeting. Yeah, I said I think that the reaction to the Fed meeting is that it's not going to be good. I think the euro went down a bit. I mean, the dollar went down a bit against the euro right after the statement came out today. But the dollar was already down against the euro before the statement. Gold was about down at one point today, down about 10 bucks. I think it finished about flat. But I think the short-term reaction, you know, the next several days, my guess is that the statement is going to be very bearish for the dollar, very bullish for commodities, very bullish for gold. Because I think, personally, it should let people know that there's no rate hikes anywhere on the horizon. Because if the Federal Reserve is basically saying they expect inflation to moderate, why should they raise rates? Right? They expect it to moderate without raising rates. They said that they see inflation expectations are elevated, but basically they're saying, you know, we disagree. We think those are false. We think people we disagree with those heightened expectations. We think they're being caused by some higher prices in things like gasoline and food, those pesky items that people see, but that's the public doesn't understand. I mean, basically what Bernanke is saying is the public is confused. They're confusing rising prices of food and energy with actual inflation. Because as far as the Fed's concerned, there really isn't any inflation. And I even had, when I was on Fox Business today, you know, somebody points out, well, based on the Fed's definition of inflation, the way the Fed defines inflation, there is any inflation. And I keep saying, well, who cares the way the Fed defines it? I don't give a darn how the Fed defines inflation. All I care about is what inflation actually is. And if they want to say there's no inflation based on their definition of inflation, I mean, what good is that? I mean, it doesn't mean anything to me if I've got to live with a rising cost of living, and if the Fed is going to say, well, based on how we define inflation, there's no inflation. All right, whatever. Big deal. But it's amazing how the people on Wall Street think that we have to live on the government's terms, that if the government says there's no inflation based on their crazy definition of what inflation is, we're supposed to just accept that and say, okay, there's no inflation. I mean, that's absurd. But, and it's amazing that the people who believe in this nonsense think I'm the one that's absurd because I don't want to accept on face value or as dogma whatever my government wants to tell me. You know, it's absolutely nuts. Anyway, let me give out the number again to call. It's 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. Also, just another word on our stocks. You know, a number of the stocks that we've been buying continue to be very volatile, mostly to the downside. You know, not all names, but some isolated stocks. And, of course, it's not just our stocks. There are many of the stocks I've looked at in some of these markets that are also getting clobbered. The people are very skittish right now. I mean, any kind of negative news. I mean, one of the stocks that we own up in Canada, which owns, fast food restaurants, got clobbered the last couple of days. And the only reason I could think of was the salmonella in tomatoes. I mean, how big a lasting impact? Yeah, they sell a lot of pizza, they use a lot of tomatoes, but I mean, you know, the market seems to take any bit of negative news light in it right now, and stocks really, really, sell off because I think the buyers just want out, people short, there's nobody to buy, the sellers want out. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity right now. There's a lot of opportunity because I think the dollar is on the verge of another huge, huge leg down. And so we got to get out of the dollar as fast as we can. And fortunately, some of these stocks, you know, we own a lot of REITs. You know, a lot of the REITs that we own around the world, and it's all commercial. We don't own any residential REITs, commercial industrial property. But, you know, one of our big positions that has been falling, we had a, you know, it had risen for the first couple of years we owned it. But it's dropped sharply along with other REITs in the last, several months. And, I mean, the stock is trading for below the level, significantly below where it was 10 years ago. Now, I wasn't even buying it 10 years ago. I mean, we started buying this one maybe 2 years ago. Hit it, dropped a lot. But now it's literally half of what it was 10 years ago, you know, in euros. Now, of course, in dollars, it's not nearly down as much because the dollar's lost a lot of value. But in price in local currency, it's a huge drop. And why? There's been a lot of inflation even in Europe. You know, why should commercial real estate be so much less valuable today than it was a decade ago? It shouldn't be. But, you know, it's just caught up. And the number of stocks now that I'm seeing with yields well in excess of 10% is shocking. You know, it used to be very hard. I mean, for a while, we were having a problem getting, you know, yields much over 6% in portfolios because so many of our favorite stocks had risen a lot in the last year or two. A lot of those gains on a lot of these stocks have evaporated. I mean, the only stocks that have been continuing to go up recently have been the energy names, our oil and gas names, our coal names, and those things. But generally, anything that's been non-energy, even the precious metal stocks have been very weak, which I think is still a great break buying opportunity. They don't pay a lot of dividends. But I still think that we're going to have an explosive move up in gold, and it's amazing that some of these stocks, you know, one of my favorite stocks in South Africa just in the last week made a new 52-week low, a new multi-year low, one of the biggest gold stocks in the world, making 52-week lows. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I just think it's a great buying opportunity. So for people who are relatively new clients and you're seeing some of these stocks drop, I know it can be a little disheartening when all of a sudden, you know, some of your stocks are going down, but you got to remember that, you know, we're not buying these stocks for any short-term paper profits. They're basically irrelevant. We just need to have our money out of the dollar in good stocks and pay good dividends, understanding that there's going to be volatility, and we're willing to accept that volatility because in the long run, we should make a lot more money owning real things, owning real companies, and having real dividend streams than just having our money in CDs and government bonds, even if they're in euros or Swiss francs or Japanese yen, because I think inflation is a global problem and global interest rates are still much too low considering how much inflation there is. And I think the best protection all around is we need to get out of the dollar, but we also need to get out of paper. We need to own real things. We need to own real wealth and real assets. And I think at the end of the game, if that's the hand we're holding, we're going to win. Anyway, let me go to the phones. The first caller is Peter from Canada. Go ahead, Peter. Is Peter there?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, you're on the air.
Yes, I got a question regarding the central banks around the world. There seems to be a large U.S. military presence around major U.S. dollar players in the Middle East and the Pacific. Do you think this has any impact on the policy of the banks and the countries? Like, do you think they're intimidated by this at all?
I'm sure they are, and I'm sure there's an element of that, you know, going around. And I think our military presence also adds to the mystique and the, you know, of our country and the perception of our power. You know, similar to the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union was feared because of its military, and it really had a status in the world that it had no economic claim to, based on the fact that they had, you know, nuclear missiles and a lot of tanks and a lot of fighter planes. But eventually the economy crumbled because it really couldn't support that military. And I think ultimately the same thing is going to happen in the United States. We really cannot afford to support the military commitments we have around the world. And I think ultimately the world will begin to fear more the consequences of continuing to prop up the United States than any type of consequences that might emerge from us no longer being able to defend them. You know, some people think that we might actually, you know, blackmail the world, you know, kind of like the mob, and demand protection money, you know, buy our bonds or we're going to bomb you. And, you know, I don't think that that's something that we would do. I mean, I mean, maybe I'm wrong there, but I don't think that American politicians would actually threaten the lives of foreigners. Telling them that we're going to drop these nuclear missiles on you if you don't ship us some, you know, some oil or some cars or, you know, buy these bonds. So, but there are people out there that are actually paranoid enough to think that that's what's going on.
And I still have one more question about commodities. You talk about buying commodities, but a lot of the commodities are traded in U.S. dollars, and I know they appreciate as the dollar falls, but is it still, like, all right to hold the commodities in U.S.?
See, they're not. I mean, the fact that they're priced in dollars or invoiced in dollars doesn't affect the underlying value. So as the dollar declines in value, those invoice prices keep rising. I mean, that is the main reason that prices are rising, because the dollar is losing value. So the prices have to constantly be escalated. Now, if oil was priced in euros instead of dollars, then the price of oil wouldn't have risen nearly as much in euros, the official price, you know. But of course, when Americans wanted to buy the oil, it would be just as expensive because they'd have to buy the euros first. But it's because they price oil in dollars that they have to constantly raise the price, because the dollar is constantly losing value.
Yes. All right, Peter, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Next up is Arnold in North Dakota.
Peter, I have put money into an exchange-traded fund which performs at double the inverse of the U.S. financials index, and it happens...
Okay, so you're short the financials.
Correct.
Okay.
And there's an ETF. It's actually a Lehman Brothers ETF. You put money in that, and then when the financial index goes down, this ETF goes up. Now, what I was wondering, so essentially what I'm doing here is I'm betting against Lehman and the brokers and the banks.
Well, in a way you're betting against them, but in a way you're betting on them. Remember, your counterparty is Lehman Brothers. What happens if your bet is so right that Lehman Brothers itself goes bankrupt?
That's what I wanted to ask you. I'm just wondering. I'm sitting here going, yeah, I hope Lehman tanks, I'll make a lot of money. Then I'm starting to think about it. Wait a second. If Lehman tanks,
they're the counterparty on your fund. They're the ones that promise to pay you that inverse relationship. And what if they can't? You're just another creditor. So in a way, you know that's the whole element of counterparty risk. Now, maybe the Fed will bail out Lehman Brothers the way they bailed out Bear Stearns, in which case you'll be okay, because now the responsibility to pay you will lie with whoever ends up owning Lehman Brothers in a transaction similar to the one orchestrated with J.P. Morgan and Bear Stearns. But, yeah, I mean, that's always the big risk, in these derivative-type instruments is the counterparty who's promising to pay you.
Would it be your expectation?
You know, you can try to hedge against that by maybe buying some deep out-of-the-money long-term puts on Lehman Brothers, because you only need them to pay off if Lehman Brothers goes broke. So if you have a big bet on this fund, you might want to take a small amount of money and buy some deep out-of-the-money Lehman puts that, if Lehman goes to zero, will pay you off in a huge way. But if Lehman only goes down like 50%, the puts will lose all their value. Because it doesn't matter to you if Lehman goes down 50%, because if they're down 50%, then they're still in business and they're still going to pay you. What you have to worry about is Lehman going to zero, in which case you want to make sure you have something that will pay you off if they go to zero. And that would be, you know, really cheap long-term out of the money, you know, deeply out of the money puts on Lehman Brothers.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Do you think it's an actual legitimate possibility that
look, if the Fed had not set a precedent of bailing out Bear Stearns, I would say that Lehman Brothers bankruptcy was 100% certitude. I mean, I would be certain that they would go under.
Mm-hmm.
Given what the Fed has already done, I don't know. Because I think if left to the market and left to their own devices, I don't see how the company would survive. So they would either go bankrupt or somebody would buy them. But given the fact that the Fed has already said, we're not letting these firms go out of business and we're going to save them in some way, then I don't know. I mean, because they could certainly change their mind and say, okay, you know, they're not too interconnected to fail. I don't know. Maybe they're not going to bail out Lehman. And the fact that I think the fact that so many people think the Fed is going to be there makes it easier for companies like Lehman to go out and borrow additional money, because now people think, well, they're not going to go under because, you know, the Fed's not going to let it happen. So just the fact that people think that there's a backstop there is helping them. I think if the Fed had made it clear, you know, from the beginning and let Bear Stearns go under, I think Lehman Brothers would have already gone bankrupt personally. You know?
Do you think the Fed could come to a point where they say, hey, we're taking all this junk onto our balance sheet, we just can't do it anymore, we're going to just start letting them fail?
I don't know that they're going to say that. And, you know, of course, the fact is if the Federal Reserve simply did their job now and raised interest rates, right, to the level that they should, that would probably bankrupt Bear Stearns, I mean Lehman Brothers, which is another reason why they're dragging their feet and leaving rates as low as they are, despite the fact that, that they should be raising them.
I heard Jim Rogers the other day. I was quite surprised to hear him say that he's buying airline stocks now.
Well, there might be some airlines around the world, you know, not in the U.S., but maybe some Asian airlines that got beaten up, that have good dividends, that have good. I'm sure he's not buying any airlines in the United States. But anyway, thanks for the call. I got a number of people on hold. Let me hop to Chris from California.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm setting my funds in today, and I wanted to ask you, what's your short-term view of where gold's going and what's your long-term view?
Well, my short-term view is up, and my long-term view is up.
Like,
my long-term view is way up.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. What about like in the next 6 months? What do you think it's
going
to go for?
I think it's going higher. You know, I think my outlook for gold generally under any period of time is going to be higher, except if we have a big rally. I mean, I think the support for gold is around 850. So right now we're around 870. So I don't think there's a lot of downside risk here, and I think, you know, that my target is to make a new high above 1,000. You know, if you call the show and gold rallies to 1,100, 1,150, then my short-term target could be potentially for a pullback or neutral, you know. But generally when you're near a support level after, you know, we're $130, $140 off the highs, I'm pretty bullish at, you know, in that situation.
Are there any forces that are holding gold back right now? Is there any way that...
I mean, obviously, there's... I mean, look, I think one of the biggest negatives for gold right now is the expectation that the dollar is going to strengthen, that the Fed and the Treasury are going to orchestrate a strong dollar policy more effectively, that the Fed's going to raise rates, that the dollar is going to strengthen, and the fear of a stronger dollar, I think, is taking some of the bid out of gold and causing maybe some people to be shorting gold because they expect the price of gold to collapse. I think when that doesn't happen, when we don't get a stronger dollar, when the Fed doesn't fight inflation, the gold will ultimately start to move higher, and that's going to force a lot of these shorts to cover these positions, and it's going to give the green light for a lot of the longs who exited the market to try to reestablish their positions. And when that happens, you can see an explosive move up, and I believe that's coming, you know. And you want to own your gold. You want to own your gold stocks. You know, you want to, you know, we're selling a lot of gold and silver over at the Perth Mint, which I think is the greatest place to store it and least expensive way to buy it. So if you don't have, a Perth Mint account yet, you should give us a call. The number to call directly there to California is 800-993-8350, 800-993-8350. And I would, you know, buy gold and silver right here before we run to new highs.
Okay, great. All right, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for the call, Chris. All right, next up is Brent from Texas.
Hey, Peter. Hey, I read your book, wrote a good review on Amazon, and got my dad involved in a client of yours. So I really, really believe the things that you've been sharing. I've been listening for about a year. It's the first time I've actually been able to get through. So I decided to use Euro Pacific for capital preservation. And because I agree with the three-pronged strategy of, one, well-paying dividends, two, protection from the falling dollar, and then currency diversification. I've only been a client for about 6 weeks, so I'm in that group that you have mentioned in the past couple of weeks about what's going on with the portfolio and so forth. But I have to tell you, I appreciate your accessibility, for answers and for call-ins, because that really helps, I think, your clients to say, okay, we need to hold the rope and keep going.
Look, we've seen these pullbacks before. You know, again, most notably, you remember, you know, we had went through a very rough patch with our Canadian Energy Trust about a year or two ago when the government, you know, first, you know, changed the tax structure. And many of these stocks were down 30-40% or more in a matter of days. And, you know, we had large positions in all these trusts. And, of course, we continue to buy them. And now some of the trusts are actually triple the prices that they were 2 years ago on the lows.
Right.
You know, so sometimes, you know, and of course, you know, the dividends have been paid the whole time, but there are a lot of people who are nervous, who are, oh, I got to sell, and, you know, that's the wrong approach. I mean, the reason that the stocks drop is so many people, you know, sold first and thought later. You know, they react to price. They think that because the price is going down, it means that there's something wrong with their stock. You know, one of the biggest winners that I have still in my personal account, and it actually cost me quite a few clients when I first bought it, because I had this one client in particular, and I wish I had the guy still, because he was a very wealthy individual. And I bought him three stocks. And ultimately, all three of these stocks increased by, I think, tenfold since I bought them. One of them was Santos in Australia, which he owned around $2. It's now over 20. Another one was the Newcrest Mining, and it was a gold stock, which we got really cheap and has gone up about tenfold. And the third one I bought him was a stock called Petroleum Geoservices, which tanked. I mean, I bought it for the guy, and it just absolutely tanked. And it was a seismic company, and the stock went down 60, 70, 80%. The guy got so pissed at me, he closed his account, and he sold the other two stocks, right? The other two stocks were ahead. They weren't way ahead. But he said, oh, you don't know what you're doing. You're, you know, you screwed up. And he was, you know, he's one of the few accounts I've lost over time. But that guy screwed up in such a major way, because the two stocks that he sold, right, ultimately went up, as I said, now tenfold from where he bought them, you know, back in like 2000, 2001. But the stock that he bought, Petroleum Geoservices, which I owned myself, I had about 50 or 60 grand in it when it went down, and my shares were worth like $2,000 or $3,000 or four. I mean, it was a huge drop. The stock almost went bankrupt. And then in the bankruptcy proceeding, they basically offer the shareholders the ability to cough up a little more money or get diluted. I mean, if you got diluted, you know, you still didn't get wiped out. You still had your shares. But I opted to cough up money. And I had to put up another 10 to 20,000. I forget what it is. I still have those shares. They're worth $600,000 or $700,000 today. Now, you know, yeah, the stock went down. But, you know, it's one of the best investments I've made. But, of course, and it, for a while, it was the worst investment I'd ever made. It even cost me a couple of clients. But in the final analysis, I was early. I wasn't wrong. I was early. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with being early as long as you're not on margin. I didn't get forced out of my position. Now, I had another position in this little stock. I remember the stock Hurricane Hydrocarbons. It ended up changing his name to Petrokazakhstan and got bought out. But I remember how pissed I was. I bought that stock at $5 a share when I first bought it. It went down to 25 cents. And when I first bought it, you know, this is going back to like 1996 or 97. I didn't have, you know, that much money back then. I was just starting out. And I bought it and I put $5,000 in it and it went down to $1,000. I was like, oh, I was pissed, you know. I doubled up at $1. So I bought another 1,000 shares at $1. And then it went to 25 cents. And I was like, oh man, I flushed this money away. You know, and instead of being upset, I should have been buying the hell out of that stock. Because a few years later, it was taken over by China National Petroleum at about $20 a share. Now, I still have my 2,000 shares. I got $200,000 for them. And the thing is, even about, I'd say about, I don't know, 6 months or a couple of weeks after they went to a quarter, when the stock started to move up, it wasn't even 6 months later, they paid a special dividend, a one-time dividend of $2 a share. I remember that. So if I had been buying the hell out of it at a quarter, you know, not in just a few months, I would have got a $2 dividend, which was, you know, eight times what I paid for the shares.
Right.
And, you know, but, you know, it was obviously disheartening for me, you know, years and years ago to see my, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 investment whittled down to $500 or $600. But in reality, that was the best opportunity. That was the best thing that could have happened to that stock because I didn't sell it. You know, I had another stock that I bought the same time I bought this Petroleum Geoservices. It was a stock called a PETD. I still have it. I have 1,000 shares. I bought it at $5, okay? And it never went down, so I never bought more. I just, you know, I never, like, it went up, and I never bought more. The stock's at $68 today. I still have the 1,000 shares I bought at $5 in my account. But I made a lot more money on Petroleum Geoservices, even though Petroleum Geoservices crashed. Because I actually, you know, took advantage of putting that extra money in during that restructuring when it was really cheap. And as a result, I ended up making a lot more money. If Petroleum Geoservices had just gone straight up from the day I bought it, I never would have had as big a position, and I never would have made nearly as much money. And there are a lot of my clients that still own that stock. I mean, they have the same story.
Right.
And, you know, but there are some clients that bailed out, and so they didn't get to make it. But the problem is the short-term performance doesn't affect the long-term performance of the stock. Anything can happen in the short run. But if we're buying in the right sectors, we're buying the right companies. Now, of course, if the company goes bankrupt and goes to zero, then there's no way to come back. And it's not impossible. Whenever you buy a stock, it's always possible that it can go to zero. But hopefully, if we have a diversified portfolio, that won't happen to many stocks. And for every stock that goes to zero, you know, and I haven't had one yet to go to zero, but for every stock that goes to zero, you know, if you're diversified, you might have another stock that goes up 10 times. And, you know, if you have $100,000 in a stock that goes to zero, you lose $100,000. If you have $100,000 in a stock that goes up 10 times, that stock's worth $1 million.
Right.
If one stock going up tenfold pays for a lot of stocks that go to zero.
Peter, I agree with the three-pronged strategy, especially with the dividends, because whatever happens in the short term, you always have the dividends. And I've noticed, here's my question. This is why I called in. Do you feel that the model will persist if many of the stocks in my portfolio decide to severely reduce or worse, eliminate their dividend like happened on one of them where they...
Yeah, well, there's a one energy trust that reduced its dividend. And, you know, I think ultimately I think the stock's a good buy here, and I think the dividend will be ratcheted back up. I mean, that's pretty much every time I've bought a big dip in any of these Canadian trusts, we've done well with it. You know, because whenever they announce any kind of reduction in their dividend, I mean, the sellers just come out in droves because people just react quickly, and it ends up being a good buying opportunity. So I'm confident that particular stock is going to come back. But, you know, some stocks might cut their dividends, you know, but other stocks will be raising their dividends. And we've had companies in the last month raise their dividends. So, you know, it's not all the stocks that are cutting. Some are cutting, some are raising. But I think over time, over a 5 or 10 year or longer time horizon, I think all of our stocks will be raising their dividends. That's my estimation. That's why we're buying them. And, of course, all the dividends are coming in other currencies. So that's going to automatically raise them from an American perspective. You know, if the dollar loses half its value, if the dividends just stay the same, they're twice as, you get twice the dollars.
Okay, well.
There's a potential with, you know, with Helicopter Ben in power right now and President Barack Obama on the way, that the dollar could lose 90% of its value. I mean, it lost 70% of its value during the 70s when the economy was in much better shape than it is today.
Well, Peter, what conditions or criteria would you remove a stock from your buy list for your clients, for us?
Yeah, we're looking. Look, there's a couple of these stocks that, you know, that I think are a little bit riskier than we originally thought based on some data. And what we've done is I've told the brokers that we're going to buy those stocks in smaller quantities. So some of the ones that seem to have some short-term credit problems, what we're doing is we still think they're great opportunities, but, you know, we're just approaching them with a smaller position. But so far there's been nothing that I've eliminated. I've said, okay, the risk on this particular stock seems to be a little higher than it was when we first bought it. We don't want to eliminate it because I think there's a lot of opportunity, but let's put a little bit less money into it and take because it's a little bit higher risk. But I think it's just some of these things are certain are special circumstances that never would have existed other than this time period.
Right. Like one of the Australians this week actually canceled their dividend.
Well, yeah, that was one of this power company because they're under pressure to raise money. And so since they're trying to reduce their debt levels and raise money, they thought, well, why should we pay out this huge dividend when we're trying to raise money and reduce our debt to equity? You know, the cheapest way to raise money is not to pay money. I mean, I think it's crazy that you've got companies in America, banks that refuse to cut their dividend, yet they're raising money in onerous terms. You know, I mean, it's a lot more honest to admit, hey, you know, right now the best thing to do is cut this dividend because it's stupid to maintain the illusion of the dividend. Let's give you a dividend with one hand, but take it away on the other hand by going out and having to raise capital at a ridiculous rate. So I think the cheapest source of capital for the company right now is not to pay a dividend. And so given what's happening right now, that probably makes sense. That upsets people. That also emboldens the shorts right away because now they can short the stock without having to pay the dividend. But ultimately, the management might be doing the right thing for the shareholders by you know giving them a little bit less money now, but giving them more benefit down the line. But anyway, it's been a long call, and I appreciate it, but I got a lot of other people on hold.
Thanks for your answer.
All right, thanks for the call. And the next call, I think, is Brent in Texas. We're going to skip the second break because I think I played it early. So we'll keep going into actually, we're almost on the third break. That's it. Time flies. But Brent from Texas. Is Brent there? All right. I'm skipping to John then in California. John, are you there?
Hey, Peter.
Hey.
Hey, got a question. Two questions for you. One is I have several savings bonds that I've had for 10 years, but they don't mature until another, like, 10, 20 years. I was wondering if I should just cash them out. And
I would.
No?
I'd cash. I mean, you're talking about U.S. dollar savings bonds, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I would. I don't think the dollar is going to have that much value. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, a few years from now. You're talking about 10 or 20 years in the future.
Yeah.
Talking about well after the Obama administration. I mean, no, I have no idea what the dollar's going to be worth. I wouldn't want to take my chances. I'd rather cash out, get what purchasing power I can now, and invest in something better.
Cool. And do you know anything about the like gold core in Guatemala? How that's affecting gold prices?
How what is?
Gold core and Guatemala. I heard something like
that. No, I have no idea.
Gold core from mining in Guatemala, and then the prices dropped a couple days ago. In gold?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, but anyway, thanks for the call. And let me take the second commercial break, and we'll be right back for the rest of the show and more calls.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that has passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back, and I think next caller is Gavin, also from California. Go ahead, Gavin.
Hi, Peter. Can you please explain the tax consequences of buying foreign stocks and the differences between buying, for instance, in the Eurozone or in Hong Kong, where one is treated as dividend earnings and the other one is treated as income. Can you explain?
Well, there's various, you know, I mean, I think in another year or two it's not going to matter because I think this tax preference is going to expire under Obama. But for now, you know, various countries may or may not have tax treaties with the United States. Singapore and Hong Kong apparently do not have a tax treaty sufficient to allow the dividends on their stocks to be qualified, so they're all non-qualified. So when you own stocks in Hong Kong and Singapore, if you get a dividend, you have to pay ordinary income taxes. Most of the other countries that we invest in, other than Hong Kong and Singapore, do have treaties, and the dividends in general are considered to be qualified dividends, and they'd be treated like any other qualified dividend. Although some of the foreign stocks that we own have been identified as passive foreign investment trusts, like let's say one of the REITs we own in New Zealand. And as a result of that, then they're not qualified dividends for that reason. They become ordinary dividends, even though they're in a treaty country. So, you know, but it's just similar. You know, you buy stocks in the U.S., sometimes the stocks pay qualified dividends, sometimes they don't. The only added complication has to do with the withholding at the source of the taxes in the country. So if you own a stock in Australia, the Australian government is going to withhold taxes from your dividend. So you're not going to get the entire dividend. If you own the security in a taxable account, you can take that tax that you pay to the Australian government and apply it as a credit on your U.S. taxes and get it all back. And then, of course, though, if you end up buying the stock in a tax-deferred account like an IRA or a pension, unfortunately, you lose the ability to claim that credit.
Now, what about for Hong Kong or Singapore? Do you have the ability to claim those withheld taxes when you're filing your 1099?
You still have the ability with those countries to get credit for the taxes you paid. The only thing you don't have is the ability to pay taxes at the lower qualified rate.
Okay, and then the other companion question very quickly is ADRs, how do they compare to that tax structure? Are you taxed in the same way? Is there withholding tax?
If it's an ADR, as long as it's not a passive investment trust, if it's an ADR, then you're fine. So if you end up buying a Hong Kong stock in an ADR or a Singapore stock in an ADR, then you're going to get the qualified dividends because the ADR is going to be what preempts it or what determines the status. But unfortunately, most of the stocks we buy are not in ADR form, and so you know, but it's interesting because if a stock has an ADR and an ordinary share, if you buy the ADR, you get the better tax treatment. If you buy the ordinary share, you don't, even though they're identical. So,
hey, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of added tax complications, but it's not that big a deal. And if you have an accountant doing your taxes, they do it for you anyway. But I think it's certainly worth the extra effort to get your dividend streams coming from abroad because, A, they're so much higher anyway. And, you know, there was just an article we had on our website, I think it was in the last few weeks, that went over executive pay that showed how much higher the executives in the U.S. are making, how much more they're being compensated than similar executives in foreign stocks. And so one of the benefits of not paying your executives so much is you have a lot more left over for the owners of the company in the form of dividends. So even though you might end up paying extra taxes on these foreign dividends, you're still left with a lot more money than if you had dividends in the United States and you were paying less taxes because the dividends are so much bigger. And, of course, the key is to get the dividends in these other currencies because that's what we're really going to need. We're going to need foreign-sourced income in foreign currencies because that's what's going to deliver more meaningfully purchasing power. Who knows what, if any, purchasing power we're going to get with the dollar. Anyway, the next caller, I believe, is Len in Texas.
In Arlington. Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Oh, yeah.
And, I'm kind of an inexperienced investor and a recent client of yours. And what happened was that, you know, I ended up buying some of those Brazilian and Australian bonds. And I have an offshore bank account, and I was going to take the money and pay off a HELOC, where I have a HELOC, and that's what I use to buy those bonds.
Equity line of credit.
Yeah, and so, but now, I heard you last week, and, you know, you were kind of talking about, you know, carry trade with stocks and dividends. And so, I find myself, with a positive interest rate. Between the HELOC and the bonds, and I'm thinking maybe I should just ride that out a little bit.
From my perspective, you know, I don't have any real estate debt because I don't own any real estate. But if I did, I would get as much debt as I could against it, and I would go and invest the money abroad. I mean, that's what I would do. And I would invest it in assets or stocks that paid me dividends that exceeded the cost of borrowing the money. And I think the only advantage I can see right now to owning U.S. real estate is that you can leverage it, that you can still borrow a lot of money collateralized by real estate at a ridiculously low rate. I mean, you know, you've got power companies in Australia having a hard time borrowing money, but you have Americans going out and borrowing all kinds of money to buy houses. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, that we can still borrow money this cheaply when more creditworthy companies abroad are having difficulty finding it. So that's going to change. This is temporary. And so it's at some point in the future, you're not going to be able to do it. So if you can lock up a 30-year loan at sub 6% or around there, I would do it because I know we can invest for a better yield than that. But, you know, it's just some, you know, there are pros and cons. I mean, some people just say, look, I don't want to have any debt. I want to have to worry about it. I want to pay off my line of credits because I want to know that I don't have any debt. Well, I mean, there's something to be said for that, too. So you decide what you want to do on your own. You know, I said what I would do if I own real estate. I don't own any, you know, so I'm just renting, and unfortunately, I can't take out a loan on my rental house.
Right. Hey, and just one last thing. What do you think about the Swiss franc? Where do you think that's going to go?
I think it's going to go a lot higher.
And so, so I've got this offshore bank account where I'm just holding that, and I'm not getting any interest. I was thinking about maybe.
It depends. If you want to keep it offshore, then keep it offshore. But your banker should be able to get find you a way to earn interest. If you want to have it onshore, you can wire those Swiss francs into your account with us, and we can buy you Swiss government bonds, you know, and get you a little interest, or we can invest in, you know, a real estate trust in Swiss and get you maybe a 4% yield, you know, get you some return, and also give you some appreciation potential beyond just sitting on Swiss francs.
Right. Real estate. So I should just mention that to my broker. He'll know. Real estate and investment in Switzerland.
Uh-huh.
Okay, great. Hey, thanks.
Yeah, and okay, thanks for the call. The next caller, I believe, is AJ from North Carolina. And I think AJ is the last caller, and we've got maybe time for one more person to call, 888-678-9597, if you want to get in, 888-678-9597. 97, and so let's talk to AJ in North Carolina.
Yeah, I just wanted to call and say I don't think a lot of people know this, but Ron Paul is facing a challenger this fall, and he'll probably get reelected, but I don't think that any of us should take for granted that he will, so we should all still contribute to his campaign, and I hope you'll tell people about that.
Well, he had a challenger for their nomination, and he handily won that. I haven't heard anything about a Democrat running for him in the general election. I thought he was going to run unopposed.
Oh, really? Well, maybe so. I was just making sure because I was just, you know.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything about him. I mean, if it's true, it could be wrong. But the last I heard, he was unopposed in the general election. He did have a challenger for the Republican nomination, right? So he was challenged in his own party by a Republican claiming to be a more mainstream Republican than Ron Paul. But Ron Paul, you know, won that election quite handily. I don't believe that he has a Democratic challenger. But, I mean, I could
okay.
call him, but, you know.
Well, the other thing I wanted to say is I've been seeing those headlines about the senators in Washington wanting to rein in the oil speculators and all that. And if that happens, wouldn't that probably help gold even more since it would take away one thing that people could hedge against the dollar in?
Yeah, I mean, it might. I mean, I think it'll help because I also think it's going to hurt. It's going to make oil prices even stronger. Look, this is all scapegoating and, you know, the government is trying to blame speculators. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's the government that's to blame. It's the government that's creating the money. They're creating the inflation. The result of what the government is doing is that oil prices rise. It doesn't make any sense at all to blame the consequences of their own actions for the problems. But of course, it wins votes and it allows the government to diffuse the public's attention from the true source of inflation, which is themselves, and to the market. I mean, I just, you know, it's like, it's basically like an obese person, you know, blaming the scale for the fact that they're gaining weight. You know, it's got to do with the scale. The scale is just reporting that they've gained weight. They're gaining weight because they're overeating and they're exercising. The same thing is happening. You know, oil prices are going up because the government is creating inflation. The rising oil price are a measure of the inflation the government has, in fact, already created. But, you know, it plays well in the media, and it makes sense to blame this all on speculators. But the reality is speculators perform a valuable and meaningful function in the marketplace. I mean, number one, speculators facilitate hedging, right? Producers who are involved in, you know, say the oil and gas market, if they want to start a project or they want to explore for something and they have certain costs, they want to be able to hedge
the risk that oil prices might collapse before their, you know, their project is done. And so the fact that there's a ready market for hedgers reduces the costs and the risks involved in developing or producing a commodity. And so speculators are there because without the speculator, who's going to take the other side of the hedger's trade? Because the hedger needs to short, right? If I want to hedge my risk on oil going down, I need to short oil. I need somebody willing to buy oil. I need a speculator willing to bet that oil is going to go up, so the risk will be transferred from me to him. And so that reduces costs for business and helps means there's more exploration, there's more development because of the ability to hedge, and ultimately that helps to reduce the cost of the commodity. And also, speculators send very important signals to the market on price discovery. You know, if a speculator, for example, or speculators believe that there's going to be a shortage of a commodity in the future, they'll buy a lot of that commodity today. That will send up the price. That will be two things. One, that will send a message to producers to go out and produce more because prices are higher. And B, it's going to create some type of supply that will now be transferred to the future by the speculators who are going to deliver these contracts into the future. And both the actions of the speculators and the actions of the producers that respond to the higher prices ultimately bring prices down in the long run and avert supply shortages. So speculators perform a valuable service in the market, yet they often get vilified by politicians. So I think anything that they do to really eliminate or discourage, you know, or abolish speculation ultimately is going to drive oil prices or any commodity prices higher if they eliminate the speculative element from the market. And of course, it's so typical of a government program because that's how the government works. The government identifies a problem, typically a problem that they created, and then they devise a program to deal with that problem, and of course, it makes the problem worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the last thing is, how come you don't run for Congress up there to help straighten things out?
Well, I mean, look. Even assuming that I could get elected to Congress, what would I do? I mean, Ron Paul is there, and he hasn't accomplished anything. I mean, he's accomplished something in that he has a podium to speak from, and people have heard what he said. But as far as actual legislation, he hasn't made a difference. I mean, he's like the votes are 450-1, right? He's the one. So if I was in Congress, it'd be 449-2. So it still wouldn't, you know, effectively change anything if I could be there too, because we'd be in such a small minority that it wouldn't really influence anything. Now, I'm glad he's there, and I'm thankful for what he's doing, and that he's got the courage to do it, and the time to do it, and the integrity to do it. I mean, I'm running this business, and I really don't think I have time to serve in Congress just to make a point. I think I can make a bigger point actually helping people protect their money and get their money out of the dollar than just being another voice in Congress when Ron Paul is already there saying everything that I would be saying. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, he speaks for me. When he says something about, you know, I feel the same way. So he's already out there getting that opinion heard in Congress. And if there was one or two more people saying the same thing, it wouldn't make that much of a difference. Now, if we can have 200 Ron Pauls in Congress, well, now there you'd have something. But, you know, one of them, unfortunately, doesn't really influence the legislation.
Yeah, I just like to turn on C-SPAN and see you and Ron.
Well, you can turn on, you can go to Fox Business or Fox News or, you know, CNN or something and see me. Unfortunately, you know, I was supposed to be on CNBC. One of the CNBC producers from a show that Deutsch, this show that called to book me. He actually booked me on the show. And I guess, and then he never called. I think somebody at CNBC found out that some producer had booked me and they said, hey, you can't have him. He's not allowed on. That must have been what's happened, you know. So they just will not let me on their airways, even when their producers want to put me on the show. Somebody up high basically, nixes the whole thing.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It looks like we got two more callers. I wanted only one more. I'll try to squeeze you both in. Peter from New Jersey, but no more calls. We definitely don't have time for any more. Are you there, Peter?
Yeah. Peter, how are you? Very informative, okay. As usual. Quick question. I read somewhere online today, I've been doing some reading, that if Israel or someone else was to attack Iran, that we would be looking at $200 a barrel oil. What would that do to the domestic and international financial markets?
Well, look, oil is already $140 a barrel, right? So $200 a barrel, I mean, what is that? So that's a 60,
it's 135 now, right? So 65 divided by 135. That's a 48% increase in the price of oil. Oil increased about 80% in the last year. So, I mean, even if there is no invasion, if oil continues at its current trajectory, we're going to get to $200 a barrel anyway. And it certainly stands to reason if there was a major disruption of oil supply in the Middle East, which would probably occur from what you just described, yeah, we can get to 200 very quickly. We can go higher. And look, it would be a negative, just like $135 a barrel of oil is a negative. The economy is in bad shape right now. You know, Americans are already suffering. They would just suffer some more. And, you know, right now, a lot of Americans are borrowing a lot of money to buy oil. I think they're putting oil on their credit cards, knowing full well they're not going to pay their bills. But at some point, Americans are going to lose access to credit cards. They're not going to be able to charge the oil. And then they're just going to have to go without it. Because, you know, if you're talking about $200 oil, you know, what is oil going to be at the pump? Maybe $6 a gallon, $7 a gallon. You know, people aren't going to have that kind of money to just keep filling up their cars. I mean, think about the minimum wage now. You know, a minimum wage worker has to work for 2 full days to buy a tank of gas. 2 full days to buy a tank of gas. I mean, that's crazy. But that shows you how much the value of wages in this country has been eroded by inflation. Probably a few years ago, you know, a minimum wage worker could buy a tank of gas with maybe, you know, six hours pay, you know, half a day. Now he's got to work 2 full days just for the gas to get to work.
You're right. And
anyway, well, thanks for the call. I got one more call. I want to make sure I get him in, and we're running out of time. Next, the last caller is Mike from Connecticut.
Hi, Peter. How are you? I got a quick question. I was at your seminar you had there in Manhattan. Were you kind of shocked that I don't know how many guests you had. It must have been about 300 or so. Were you kind of shocked that nobody could, you know, create any kind of a debate with you? Or?
Well, we weren't there to have a debate. It was people were there to hear me speak. I'm sure if I wasn't really trying to incite a debate.
But you would think out of the amount of guests that were there, somebody would have, you know, came up with a good argument against your position.
Well, I mean, remember, I mean, the people that were there were people that I had sent emails to from my database. So, I mean, it's not a random sampling of people. I'm sure if I just, you know, gave a speech in front of 300 random Americans, that there'd be quite a few people who would disagree with me. They might not be able to give me a great debate, though. I might be able to, you know, out-argue them. But yeah, no, I wouldn't be surprised that you get a lot of people who would agree with me in a room full of people who were in my database who came to hear me speak. But and you know, but people do ask me questions. You know, they don't necessarily try to start an argument. But yeah, I mean, look, I mean, if you want to see people disagree with me, just look at all the videos. You know, you can listen. I did this web debate, which, you know, they unfortunately was only open live to 100 people. And actually, of the 100 people that signed up, only 50 people attended. But it's on Real Asset Advisors website. And if you go to that website, Real Asset Advisors, whatever, Real Asset Investors, it was a debate with me and Mike Norman. It was a one-hour debate. We did it live yesterday. And you can hear the replay of it up on that website.
Okay, great. Another question. I'm a mortgage broker in Connecticut. Where do you see this industry in about 2 years?
Look, it's going to continue to contract. You know, mortgage credit is going to be harder and harder to come by. You know, fewer and fewer Americans are going to be buying homes, and when they do buy homes, it's going to be tough to get mortgages. They're going to have to put significant down payments, and I think real estate prices are going to fall sharply, which means when they do borrow money, the loans are going to be smaller. And so to the extent that the fees are based on the size of the loans, it's going to be tough for the industry. Anyway, thanks for the call. I am running out of time. Anyway, thanks, everybody. Last few seconds. Don't forget to call 800-727-7922. Go to the website www.europac.net. Don't forget to buy copies of Crash Proof and visit Amazon and click on the #2 review from a Financial Sense listener that the review is helpful and it's moving up on the list. Thanks, everybody. I'll be back again next week, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So long.